Hello and welcome to another episode of Music Rabbit Hole. I'm your humble host and music bus driver on today's musical journey. New series on the channel. This is a series called Albums You Should Listen To Before You Die. This is episode one. And look, I know the title sounds a little morbid. I don't want you to be necessarily thinking about death, but the general idea is there are certain records that I feel like if you are a fan of music, you should listen to because of their cultural significance or their impact or their nuance, like new techniques or things like that. The idea is really good albums in general. And so I have a Spotify playlist, actually, that I put these albums on. It's a work in progress, but I will put the link in the description as well as the link to the album we're going to be talking about today. So the general idea is I'm going to deep dive, however you want to say it, into this record. Provides a lot of background, some of my thoughts, and with the idea of, hey, I think you should listen to this. So that's what I'm trying to get you to do. I will not be playing any songs from the album here today on this episode because you run the risk of the video being taken down by YouTube. So I advise you to either maybe listen to the record before listening to this or after listening to this or during. I mean, if you got multi-speakers or whatever. But regardless, to really understand the full impact of the words I'm going to be talking about, I would definitely recommend you listening to the record. By the way, if you haven't already, please subscribe and like the channel. If you're listening to the audio, there is a video YouTube channel where I put a video version of this. There's visuals and pictures accompanying this episode, so I do recommend you watching the video. But if you're a podcast listener, you've got the show available in podcast form as well. All right, let's get into this. Today's episode will focus on the fourth studio album of Cincinnati natives, The National, one of my favorite bands. And we're going to be covering the album Boxer that they put out in 2007, May 22nd, 2007. Before we get to Boxer, though, let's recap how the band got here in the first place. So in 1991, lead singer Matt Berninger and bassist Scott Devendorf met in the graphic design department at the University of Cincinnati. They eventually formed a... By the way, this is a lot of this history comes from a great book in the 33 and a third book series by Bloomsbury Publishing. This book was by Ryan Pickard, and it's a oral history of the album and their early years, and it's a great book series in general for those who want to learn about the origin of albums and kind of the story there. So 33 and a half and a third book series. So they got together, they formed a Pavement-esque garage rock band called Nancy, including one album, Ruther 3429, which you can find on YouTube. Later on, Matt and Scott, along with other musicians, Scott's brother Brian, and then another set of brothers, Aaron and Bryce Dessner, they link up in Brooklyn. They find a practice space. They all love playing music. They all have been in bands over the years. So they move to Brooklyn. They find a practice space. They all have regular jobs, white collar desk jobs, finance or design or. They're grinding in the work world, but they also still enjoy music, and they're doing this on the side, and they eventually put together enough tracks to form a self-titled record in 2001 that they put out on Brassland Records, which was actually Aaron and Bryce Dessner's own label. And so they put out this self-titled record. The group hadn't even played any shows yet, according to Aaron Dessner. He says, "We just did it to just do it." Now, the initial album comes off kind of in that Wilco alt-country vein. That was some of the sound of the time. Pitchfork, one of the premier reviewing sites, and it's still to this day, but back then, Pitchfork had a ton of power as almost a gatekeeper of the music scene, where a good rating on Pitchfork could make all the difference for your band's trajectory. And they really were kind of the tastemakers. Now it's a little different because we have so much access and bands are putting things out independently and all these different, there's a bunch of different review sites. Obviously, I even do reviews on this site. So Pitchfork's significance in the culture is not as large as it used to be. But back then, a big rating mattered a lot. And the self-titled small record found its way to this Pitchfork writer who gave it a 6.6 out of 10 at the time, and which was big. I mean, for a band's first record, a decent score. And the National had not fully found their soon-to-be sound yet, but they soon would. They eventually put out a second record, Sad Songs for Dirty Lovers, in 2003, and this record had them working with real-time producers, Paul Heck and Peter Kadis. Now, Peter Kadis has probably worked on some of your favorite indie rock albums over the years, including working with Interpol on Turn on the Bright Lights, Tokyo Police Club on Elephant Shell, Jukebox the Ghost, Guster, We Were Promised Jetpacks, Frightened Rabbit, The Head and the Heart, Augustine's, Blind Pilot, and even Deathcap. There's a multitude of artists and bands that Peter Kadis has worked on that you probably have heard. With Kadis's help, the National was able to turn this... They described it as this pile of crap. They had all these recordings. They weren't done correctly. They weren't mixed correctly. And they basically handed it over to Peter Kadis and said, you know, help us. And he was able to turn it into something really releasable. And Pitchfork gave this second record an 8.4 out of 10. So once you get that, combined with the 2004 EP Cherry Tree, this now gave them enough steam to quit their day jobs, sign with the label Beggar's Banquet, and they started going on tour, including with a band that, one of my favorite bands that also really helped them find their footing was this band called The Walkmen. And at the time, The National and their lead singer, Matt Berninger, they were still trying to figure out their live presence, their live show. And Berninger especially was trying to figure out his swagger on stage. And The Walkmen and their lead singer, whose name slips my mind, but they exuded so much confidence on the stage that I think it really helped The National figure out what their live show was going to be. So they, after that record and the EP, and they signed with the label, and in 2005, the group released their first record underneath that label called Alligator. And they really broke through with this album. This led them to festivals, sold-out show, top album lists. Alligator really put them on the map. So you have your big label debut, and now it's time to do your follow-up because there's so much momentum being generated here. Each album is kind of built on the previous album, and so there's so much expectation. And this is how the band found themselves in Bridgeport, Connecticut, in a three-story Victorian home called Tarquin Studios to work on this second record for the label. So they enter the house in June, and they're eager to begin the process. The recording studio sits in the third floor of the house, the living quarters and the kitchen on the first two levels. It was a really hot summer that year, and a lot of the time the members could be found crowded in the TV room with the one-unit AC blasting and watching World Cup that year. And this was also the home where Peter Kadis and his wife lived as well, and that caused a lot of stress for them. But this was the idea was get out of Brooklyn, get out of the city, go and be isolated in this space where you're going to be living and recording, and you're literally living with your engineer and producer, and to try to come up with something great. Padma Newsome, the band's honorary member, provides the strings and horn arrangements that can be heard on songs like Mistaken for Strangers or Gospel. The band also worked for the first time with pianist Thomas Bartlett, who stayed with the band after this record from then on. So in this space, the group experimented a ton, turning over every idea. There was the studio upstairs that had kind of limited recording ability, obviously, because only so many people can be recording in there at one time. So they set up a secondary recording space in a storage room in another part of the house. And this room actually, well, you have your main recording space. The secondary space kind of was a room of experimentation. Things like hitting a broken fan that found its way onto the song Apartment Story, or trying weird drum sounds. And so this was definitely kind of the room to try things. Also along the process, Matt Berninger became very solitary. He wasn't really a collaborative writer, besides working actually with his wife, who we'll get to her later. He really didn't necessarily collaborate a lot on lyrics. So a lot of the time you'd find him isolated in his room, working on lyrics, trying to find the right words. Because for a front man and for you know, the guy who's writing the lyrics, there's a lot of pressure here as well, beyond just the instruments side of things. there is the pressure of trying to stay true to the band and their messaging and your messaging and your ideas. And so Berninger was struggling with that. And with Berninger, he has this, if you've heard The National, you obviously recognize his rich, deep baritone voice, which actually caused a lot of issues in the early live shows as a band, because Berninger sings kind of soft, but not necessarily soft, but it's lower. It's obviously in a lower register. He isn't a big screamer, except for on some tracks. So they had a lot of hard times trying to get the right mix for the live shows to make sure his voice was still heard. And it's similar on the records as well, as they're trying to find a way to make sure that his voice and his lyricism is shining on the records. At the time in the world, this was a very angsty political time here. This was, the Bush years. There's war going on. There's prison tortures. There's Hurricane Katrina. There's a lot of gloom going on in the country in that early 2000s era. And that's what is really felt on this record with Berninger's lyrics, is there's an aspect of escapism. You're trying to find the light in a dark and scary world. So a lot of songs on Boxer, and I'll be going through each track, but a lot of songs on Boxer are just about avoiding scary stuff, you know, being at home, putting Christmas lights out in the garden, drinking wine, smoking cigarettes with somebody you love. These were all things that Berninger said, regarding kind of where some of the ideas come from. And on this album as well, Berninger refused to scream on this record, as he did on past tracks like Mr. November or Murder Me, Rachel, which were on previous albums. There was moments of him, Mr. November on the live show is one of the most climactic moments of the show. It's usually played as an encore, I guess, because Berninger puts it all out there. He's screaming the whole time. So with this record, he ended up trying to texture his voice by singing in different positions, like laying down or slouching, or just basically trying to find different techniques to find the right sound without venturing into like screaming territory or anything like that. He wanted to stay inside himself, but try different things. So 3 months passed by. The group had a large collection of songs, but there was no clear vision on how to put it all together. They were re-recording constantly. They really didn't have the album that they were kind of hoping to have. Arguments about the quality of the work happened a lot. There was stress and there was friction involved. Some of this is evident in Vincent Moon's documentary that follows the band through its process called A Skin, A Night, which is great if you haven't seen it. And so the idea was you record through the summer and they would have something to present the label in the fall. And now that clearly was not going to happen. They had this collection of 20 songs, but they kept re-recording and changing direction, and it just was not working. So Kate has finally said, you guys go leave, go back home, go finish the record somewhere else, and then get it back to me. And in his words, I'll mix the shit out of it later. So they all return to Brooklyn. They're playing some shows. They're trying to re-record the album actually in one of the members' attics in Brooklyn. And what they just kind of decided was that some of the songs they recorded in the studio were just too polished. They were too studio sounding, which they liked for the drums, but for the other instruments, they wanted more of an authentic kind of messier sound. So they were getting that in the attic, and so they were re-recording. They were even working with Sufjan Stevens as well, was a big help for them and provided a lot of guidance. And so they worked through the winter, and then a few weeks after New Year's, they returned to Tarquin Studios for the final mix with Peter Kadis. And then after a bunch of rounds of debate, they finally have a finished package to send their label. Now, the reaction to the finished package was not great from the label side. This was different. I mean, you keep in mind that this band's previous albums were harder rock, more screaming involved here at times. And this album was so much more nuanced and strings and horns and all this piano, and it just wasn't the same as that Alligator record. And so the label was expecting something similar to that previous album, and so they were a little confused by the album. So that kind of unnerved the band even more. They even were like, hey, maybe we should just leak the thing or do it ourselves. But eventually, after 13 months of hard work, The record was ready for release. They start the promotion tour. The album comes out, receives an 8.6 out of 10 from Pitchfork, and lands on Pitchfork's Best New Music section, which, again, I have to stress the significance of that, especially in the early 2000s, as Pitchfork was kind of the tastemakers of the time. If you landed on something like the Best New Music section, that is an unbelievable accomplishment. And so, you know, from there, that really kind of took the band to a whole nother level. They obviously put out other albums, High Violet in 2010, in 2013, Trouble Will Find Me, which was nominated for a Grammy, in 2017, Sleep Well Beast, which won a Grammy, and their eighth studio album, I'm Easy to Find, which was released in 2019. And I believe they have their next record. They've been releasing singles from it, so their next record, First Two Pages of Frankenstein, will be coming out at some point this year. So let's kind of go track by track a little bit here as far as the album as a whole, because again, I recommend you going and listening to it on your own, maybe pausing it after each of these track descriptions if you want. But the album starts with Fake Empire, and I would argue that this is its best track. There's this C major progression on the piano running through the song, as Berninger speaks of being half awake in a fake empire. And this can be read to be an allusion to the state of the world as we're caught halfway between conscious thought and daydreams in this world of mixed realities. Berninger explained in an interview that the song is about trying to avoid thinking about the state of the world. You're distracting yourself. You're trying to find other happier things. Halfway through the track, there's this, the drums join in. There's this large orchestral horns and this crescendo of sound. And this track in particular has been used on a multitude of TV shows and things like that. They played it live on David Letterman in 2007. That was their television debut. And again, I feel like it is their best track on the album, and it is a great album in general. So what a way to start off the record. Track two, Mistaken for Strangers. The second track on the album follows this familiar theme of this album and the National in general, this idea of transition to adulthood. A lot of the National's work, it covers that fear and trepidation and worry and all those feelings that happen as you are a young adult entering the working world and still trying to grasp to the past. And so with Mistaken for Strangers, it's all about the business of the working world. The character in the song has transformed so much that his friends mistake him for a stranger when they pass him on the street. The drums of Brian Devendorf truly drive this track, and as well as a lot of the tracks on this album. Drums are really key to the National sound, the different syncopation of Devendorf, the different fills. I mean, this is a theme throughout. But the track two, Mistaken for Strangers, another really solid one. Track number three, Brainy. Berninger said in an interview with Paste Magazine that Brainy is about someone trying to pretend they're smarter than they are. They're trying to catch up to somebody who's way ahead of them. They talk about, in the song, there's lyrics about, I read the dictionary last night, and, you know, trying to impress this person that, I'm intelligent, I'm just as smart as you are. Another strong drumming track from Devendorf. There's these minimal guitar riffs played off in the distant background. Another great song. They're all great. Number four, Squalor Victoria. This is another really, really, one of my favorite songs on the album. And the interesting one with this one is Berninger didn't even have lyrics for this for the longest time. It was kind of at the last hour that he finally put together something. Originally, they were even considering, are we just going to do an instrumental track on the album? And there's this military-esque drum pattern that opens the track. There's these strings that come in playing this mournful tune. The piano kicks in. This is another track about growing up in this new adult working world, the struggles you experience in your first occupation. There's this kind of celebratory mood at times, the screaming this yelling of Squalor Victoria, and the celebration of, yeah, just being over your head, you know. Track number five, Green Gloves. This song is about trying to remember someone and be them you're trying to connect with somebody from your past, somebody that you've lost touch with, and you're trying to connect, you're trying to be inside their clothes, inside their life. You're watching their shows. There's lines around, yeah, watching the same shows that they are, and I'm wearing the same clothes as them, and you miss them so much that you want to, that you have to become them in order to connect with them again. There's this acoustic guitar, the backing piano, the occasional big drum booming in the background over a relatively creepy idea with Green Gloves there. Track 6, Slow Show. This track is about the panic of being in a public party when you just want to be back home with your significant other. This is there's a beautiful romance to this track. This kind of begins this, there's this arc on this album about relationships, this 3-track arc, and really 3 or 4 track arc here in the middle of the album. And this starts that off. There's this song apparently gets played at a lot of weddings. And there's a cool little note about this is it actually connects, there are lyrics that connect to the Nationals' debut album, the self-titled record. That there's a song on that called 29 Years, which is about Matt Berninger's wife, Karen Besser, who the outro of the track includes the exact lyrics from that song, 29 Years. And Karen Besser played a key role in the National and in Berninger's writing as well. She collaborated with him many times on the lyrics and getting her input. So really a strategic partner to the band, especially with her husband, Matt Berninger. Track 7, Apartment Story. This track is continues this idea of these kind of romance and relationship tracks. There's these minute details of a couple getting ready for some sort of party or gathering. It also covers the reality of entering into a serious relationship as adults, how different it is from, you know, puppy love, and now, you know, we are a serious thing here, a serious couple, with the rapid pace of life and the new world and all these different factors involved. The guitar rings out loud in the chorus, almost in a kind of anthem type style. There's some really interesting techniques on the guitar here in Apartment Story. Track 8, Start a War. This track almost kind of rounds out the relationship song arc, as this one describes a fraying relationship, and the narrator is in denial of the situation in a way. They keep threatening to start a war, start this big fight, but they never cross that line. They come up with excuses saying, you know, the money or humor can save them and save the relationship. There is this building instrumental background to it that is building as the narrator is talking about starting a war. So it's almost like we're going to be building this crescendo, this battle, this war. But the song eventually peters out as the narrator likely never got the courage to truly fight. Track 9, Guest Room. This song is just another track about reminiscing about the old days, which is so different to their adult lives now. Not a whole lot of info that I have on that one. Track 10, Racing Like a Pro. This is another track about how the narrator is was once a young ruffian and troublemaker, and now has to deal with the working world. And there's no life outside of the job. There's all these little mundane tasks like baking a cake or doing these activities, but seemingly has just no life beyond work at this point. And there's depression and things like that involved, as there are some days you can accomplish things, there's other days you can't. And he's just shocked at how different his life is now. Track 11, Ada. This track is a conversation with a woman named Ada as the narrator is trying to give her advice about her social anxieties. Sufjan Stevens' piano playing is heard heavily on this track. Beautiful piano accompaniment. And then the last track on the album, Gospel. The last track seems to continue the theme of relationship activities. This is where talking about, well, the world's kind of crumbling. They'll play these pretend games. They'll set up Christmas lights outside. They'll do these fun things here just to kind of escape the realities of the world. And so I feel like the National, and that's the last track on the record. So I feel like the National and this album really hit a lot of folks who are maybe in their mid-20s or late-20s or even early 30s, the people that are reminiscent or nostalgic, rather, for their past, for the fun times of being a young adult and before life got too serious. And that's why I feel like The National hit so hard, because they really truly captured those emotions on this album. And I think so many people were able to connect with that with the lyrics and that record, because they're feeling the same thing. They're feeling, they're having relationships that are struggling because of how the real world impacts them, and they're working jobs maybe they don't love, and they just miss the old days. And so Boxer does a great job capturing that, all the while with using all this great instrumentation with pianos and strings and horns and Berninger's vocals and lyrics really piercing through, and the drums being so strong. Guitar playing is a key piece as well. And it's all really thanks to not only the members of the band, but Peter Kadis, who did a tremendous job on the engineering and production side of things. And basically functioned as another member of the band with how involved he was on things. So I, this album in particular received a lot of acclaim. It was in Paste magazine. It was named the best record of 2007. Mistaken for Strangers was number 92 on Rolling Stone's list of the 100 best songs of 2007. I mentioned Pitchfork's ratings. They also named it number 17 on its top 50 album list for that year. This is a record that doesn't necessarily define the band, because I think they have put out some, it's not like this was their peak and they haven't done anything better since then, because they honestly have. They've done some great albums, but I think this is a great representation. The reason why I find this important and why I wanted to spotlight this album is it's a great example of a band when all the pressure is on them to come up with another great record after putting out Alligator, that they were able to do it even unconventionally. They tried living in studio 3-month house thing. It didn't work. But what actually tended to work was going back to their roots, going for a messier sound, recording in an attic, and really giving themselves the space and the time to produce the best possible version of their work. All of the help with, obviously, some tremendous professionals along the way. And another little side note, funny thing is I believe the album cover is from Peter Kadis's wedding to his wife, and that's the National. There was a wedding band that played at the wedding, but throughout the night, different people that played instruments were able to go up on the stage, and the National actually was able to do that at the time, and so they're standing on a stage, and a picture was snapped, and that's where that picture comes from on the cover of Boxer. I hope you listen to this. I hope you listen to this record. Obviously, you're listening to this episode, but I hope you listen to this record. It is definitely worthwhile listening for folks in the indie rock, folk rock type realm that they enjoy. If you've never listened to The National, this is a great way to get introduced to them, and I hope you enjoy this episode. So again, please like, comment, and subscribe to the show, both on the podcast form and the YouTube form. I put out YouTube shorts every single weekday where I do a 1-minute album review, so a lot of great info there. Otherwise, I will see you guys next week. This has been another episode of The Music Rabbit Hole. Have a good one.